Welcome to Thelema Now, a podcast about Aleister Crowley, ritual, and magic. Our guest today is Richard Kaczynski, author of Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, and The Wiser, Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley. And now here is your host, Frater Puck.
With our will shall be the whole law. Greetings and welcome, Richard. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I just want to start a little bit with your background. I know that I guess it was probably the late 70s you first got involved studying the metaphysics, the occult, that type of thing?
Correct.
Since then, you've become quite the authority in such matters, but you're also a doctor.
Yes, a PhD.
What would you say to somebody who might find that surprising?
Oh, I don't see there's really a contradiction there. There's a lot of people who have this assumption that because someone is involved in the paranormal or the occult, that they're not very bright or they don't know better. And that is not, in fact, the case. And part of what I studied in my doctoral dissertation, in fact, was I'm trying to debunk the sort of assumption that's behind a lot of research into believers in this unusual stuff, that somehow, you know, believers are uneducated or naive or somehow socially disenfranchised. And, you know, I found out that through my surveys that that's not the case. People who are, you know, who are involved in some aspect of metaphysics are, in fact, well-educated, they have jobs, good incomes, and they are good critical thinkers, just the same as anybody else. They just happen to be interested in this stuff.
Kind of brings to mind the motto of the Equinox, the method of science, the aim of religion. And as a doctor, what could you say, how that might be relevant to your experience?
Well, I mean, it certainly helps to be a critical consumer, but not only of the literature, but also of the practices and the exercises that are part of it. Crowley talks a lot about, you know, this method of science stuff, but, you know, he doesn't really spend a whole lot of time going into, you know, what is the scientific method, research design methodology, or statistics, or any of that kind of stuff.
Correct.
And, my training in psychology actually prepared me to actually sit back and critically appraise what I do, and in fact, I'm writing an article for the new issue of Neshama, which is the journal of the OTO Psychology Guild, on this very topic, because while we talk about the method of science and the aim of religion, I'd actually like to be able to put some meat on that motto and, you know, give people an introduction to these topics and some tools that they can use to apply this to their own practice.
Your most recent book is The Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley from Wiser. What could you tell us about that?
Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley was an attempt to provide an introductory book to Aleister Crowley and his magic. And the format that we have, because The Concise Guide is a series that Wiser is producing, is limited to 128 pages, with text and, you know, whatever images are necessary. And the real challenge was to take a topic as complicated as Crowley and to give people an introduction not only to his life but to the magical organizations that he started, and also just an introduction to some of the magical practices that he recommends and where all this stuff comes from. Now, it's kind of a tall order, but I think we pulled it off.
Right. Was there a peer review process involved with the book?
And in fact, there was. The introduction to the book by the editor, James Wasserman, talks about how he originally wanted to write this book, but because of other commitments, he had to find someone else to do the writing. But he wanted to be very much involved in, you know, the editorial process, and he felt very strongly that he wanted this book to be solid and as definitive as possible within the limitations of the page count.
Sure.
And part of that rigor that he wanted was to have the manuscript reviewed by, you know, a panel of experts. And in that sense, it was very similar to an academic peer review process for a refereed journal.
Sure.
The main difference is that in a peer-reviewed journal, The review process is blind. That means the reviewers don't know who the author is of the manuscript they're looking at, and the author of the manuscript doesn't know who the reviewers are. So all that was out in the open. But at the same time, the reviewers of my manuscript were not just people with some passing familiarity with the subject, but they were some of the top scholars and leaders in Thelema in the world today. So it was, you know, I was very fortunate and actually comforted knowing that, you know, these people were taking a look at my manuscript, because that would help me to make this the best possible book.
Sure, sure. Being a concise guide, and you kind of mentioned how hard it was to fit so much that could be some real helpful information in such a short guide. What were some of the hardest decisions you had to make as far as what couldn't make it, or what was the process to decide just how much of something to put in? What more could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a slippery slope, because until the book is actually typeset, you know, it's hard to say, you know, how long something's going to be, even though we had like a word count that I was shooting for. But sure, there were segments that I wrote, you know, something, and much of what was cut was actually cut because it was probably not necessary for the beginner level person that we were writing to. And just as a few examples, I had a section about what to expect when you go to your first Gnostic Mass. And, you know, Jim, as editor, kind of felt that, well, if someone's going to the stages of actually contacting the OTO body and going to their first Gnostic Mass, that's something that they will get, you know, as a congregant on site, and they don't necessarily need that in the book. I had also written a couple of, I had written one chapter on intermediate magical techniques, dealing with invocation, evocation, the great magical retirement, and things like that. And that had to go, just wasn't enough room. And likewise, my last chapter was on sex magic, which is something I felt, you know, that was the elephant in the room. You know, everyone knows it's part of Thelema, but no one wants to talk about it. And I felt like, no, I've got to say something about this. And in the chapter I wrote was about twice as long as what wound up in the book. But once again, it was just one of these things that, you know, we just need to get people started, and we refer them to other places they can read to get more information. So, you know, those more advanced topics we had to just kind of scale back to fit into our page count. And that was, you know, those decisions, you know, largely, you know, while Jim Wasserman ran those by me, you know, it was largely his, you know, experience and wisdom that allowed, you know, this book to be kind of fit into the space that we had with, you know, the best edits, you know, that needed to make it what it is.
You also are an extensive writer in various medical fields. The standards, I imagine, are different, but how are they comparable from the writing you do for the various articles in terms of metaphysical-type subjects?
Well, if you go into the New Age section of your favorite bookstore, you know, you'll find a lot of fluff out there. So it's kind of hard to speak to, you know, other books in general. But, you know, myself, coming from academia, I do hold myself to a very high standard of scholarship in everything that, you know, I personally write.
Sure.
And when you look out there, it's very heartening, at least to me, to see that the study of occultism in academia has become an acceptable area of research in the last few years. And this happens in fields like history, religion, and the social sciences. And I think we're very fortunate that if you go out there, you can find fantastic scholars like Marco Posse, Claire Fanger, Henrik Bogdan, and Marcia Keith Schuchard, just doing this, writing fantastic scholarly stuff out there. So in that sense, there isn't much of a difference, because there's some of the best literature out there is coming from academia.
Interesting. When do you think that started turning, or has this always been something that's been kind of a well-kept secret, and only people who really study the occult would realize that there's actually serious scholarship that's always been going on?
I have to say that's probably been in about the past maybe 15 years, maybe 20 years. I mean, it's been probably a gradually growing thing, but I probably became aware of it, fortunately, after I finished my dissertation, because if this had been going on beforehand, I might have done something differently. But, you know, things turned out, you know, fine for me in that regard, but it's been pretty much in the last 10 or 15 years I've really seen that happening. There's a series put out by Pennsylvania State University on magic and history that's just amazing, and, you know, SUNY Press has a whole series on Western esotericism, and these are all, you know, have come up fairly recently in, you know, history.
You mentioned your doctoral dissertation. What could you tell us about the central idea behind it?
Well, I had come into psychology as someone who had been an aspirant since, you know, I was 14 years old, thinking that I'd find a lot of insight that would help me explain how this thing we called magic really works as a transformative tool for illumination. And while I did find some answers, I also found that the field was kind of out of touch with the subject. And, you know, I couldn't really explain how something like personality, which is usually defined as, you know, stable characteristics, could just change in the blink of an eye in the face of a transformative religious experience. Likewise, I found that a lot of the surveys that people put together to measure belief in the paranormal asked some fairly ridiculous questions from the perspective of someone who is, you know, the being addressed by those questions, or from the standpoint of a believer or practitioner. For example, I mean, one of the questions was, "I believe that witches exist." And, you know, I mean, can you imagine asking that question about any other minority group or religion?
Right.
You know, I believe that Mormons exist. Well, of course they exist, you know. And a lot of the research was, you know, they were interviewing and surveying, you know, Psych 101 students, you know, and what do they even know about this stuff?
Right.
So it was just they were using a convenient sample. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, the assumption was something called the marginality hypothesis. And this is kind of the bias that was running through all the research, that anyone who was involved in the paranormal or the occult was involved because they were either too uneducated, poor, female, black, or otherwise socially disenfranchised to know better.
Gotcha.
And
right.
It just struck me as just this really insulting sort of assumption.
Yeah.
And my research was geared to not only test and ultimately disprove this hypothesis, but also just kind of get a better handle on the nature of metaphysical beliefs from a more informed standpoint, I guess.
Right.
And, you know, in my research, I found out that, you know, none of these assumptions are true. You know, as I mentioned, people who are involved, and that was one of my criteria. I wasn't surveying, you know, psychology students. I was interviewing people who were, you know, in some way participating in their religion or their spirituality, by attending festivals, by going to rituals, and you're not just asking the general person on the street.
Right.
And these participants were actually educated, they were employed, they could make good critical judgments and so on. So none of these assumptions about the marginality hypothesis held. And moreover, the best predictor of someone being involved in the occult was having had at some point in their lives a transformative spiritual experience.
Right. Would you say that was true of you?
Yeah, I've often felt that I didn't so much find the path or stumble down the path as, in my own life circumstances, just created a situation that kind of kicked me down the path.
You want to tell us more about that?
Well, it's kind of hard to even know where to begin, you know. And of course, you know, a transformative experience is a highly personal thing. But it struck me as kind of that I grew up in just this time, and you know, most of the people in my peer group probably can relate to this. Was that, you know, it was in that generation. I was just young enough to watch, you know, as a little boy, Star Trek, and because, you know, I liked Mr. Spock, I had to watch In Search Of, because it was narrated by Leonard Nimoy.
Of course.
And that was also at the time that there were, you know, a lot of talk about UFOs and the Project Blue Book, and I had a sister who had done a independent study in junior high school on witchcraft, and so she had brought, like, incense and tarot cards and stuff into the house.
Oh,
and I can remember as a young teenager going to the local grocery store and buying books like Francis King's Techniques of High Magic as a mass market paperback.
Right.
And making my mom buy me this book, you know, and just the idea that you would find a book on high magic in the grocery store, I mean, it just blows my mind, because you'd never see that today. But that's the kind of stuff that was just the fabric of my life everywhere I turned.
Sure.
You know, so I just kind of feel like from the womb I was kind of set up to walk this path.
Yeah, I can see that. So, as a very active and visible participant in OTO, EGC, as an authority on Thelema, Aleister Crowley, and these types of things, now that it's 2009 and you did your dissertation in, was it 1993?
Yes.
Is this all part of the postdoctoral experiment in a sense? Your aspiration, your continued work? Or is it's just all the same path?
Yeah, I think it kind of all is the same path. I mean, you know, I've got a lot. I do think I have a diversity of interests, which is healthy. And, you know, whether I'm, you know, in a classroom teaching or whether I'm writing a book or whether I'm, you know, performing a piece of music, my goal in all of these is always to get people to think about, you know, the world and what's going on around them and to kind of ask those deeper questions.
Sure. Yeah, you're a musician too. So what could you tell us about, like, the House of Usher?
Well, there's really nothing terribly metaphysical about the band House of Usher, but it was the most recent, you know, band that I participated in. And, you know, it was a prog rock band, and, you know, prog rock being, you know, the style of music that uses, you know, more virtuosic, you know, arrangements, kind of, you know, borrows classical and jazz song forms and things like that. And it really lends itself well to those sorts of thought-provoking topics. You know, it's not necessarily stuff that's always about love songs, but things that can really address deeper subjects. And, you know, music, you know, beginning with the Beatles and, you know, running through, you know, the hippie counterculture movement of the 60s and, you know, even through shows like Live Aid and, you know, modern political bands. I mean, it's always been this, has this capability of being a tool for social and spiritual change. And, you know, whether you're looking at, you know, U2 or Green Day, you know, music can be about more than just, you know, silly love songs, as Paul McCartney would say.
Right.
And that's been kind of, you know, my interest. You know, I find that the prog rock approach, you know, lends itself to that, and it's, you know, challenging, you know, creatively as a musician and in terms of putting out some kind of a message.
Sure. Are you working on any kind of musical project that is more, as you said, House of Usher wasn't really metaphysical.
No. Our lyric book actually had a lot of alchemical and Kabbalistic woodcuts, and that's my fault because I actually designed the internals of the book, and I wanted to incorporate that somehow. But I kind of felt like, you know, the album is called Body of Mind, and so having these pictures of, you know, the Vitruvius's, you know, microcosm and things like that worked with the title. I have every intention of doing more musical work that's more, you know, again, gets into things that are closer to my own, you know, heart in terms of subject matter. I'm just currently with my writing projects a little too distracted. I hope to see the light at the end of the tunnel soon.
Right. Speaking of projects that you may have been working on a long time, is there any project you've been working on particularly long that, can you guess what I'm about to ask about?
I know what you're talking about. Well, the one I've been working on for a long time that you're referring to is the edited and annotated edition of Aleister Crowley's Sort of Song. And this is a book that I think is possibly Crowley's most underrated work. I see it as being a sibling to his later book, Conks on Pox, which he wrote just 3 years later. I mean, they have poems, they have skits, they're funny and profound at the same time. And they don't make a whole lot of sense unless you're really familiar with your history or with what Crowley's talking about.
Right.
And that was my experience with Sort of Song. It's a really deep, deep, deep book that just keeps getting, you know, that just goes deeper and deeper. And but there's references that he makes and things that he talks about that were inside jokes that made sense 100 years ago. But today, you know, the joke needs explaining or the reference needs explaining. And I've added literally hundreds of footnotes to the book explaining these things. Because, you know, Crowley, you know, is sticking in some weird reference or some joke on almost every line of poetry. You know,
of course.
And I want the book to be something that people can pick up and read and understand and appreciate. So there's, you know, there's a lot of new content that I've generated. I was almost done. And then I decided, you know, let me compare this version, which is kind of a combination of the first edition and then the kind of the expansion and the stuff he added when he reprinted it in the collected works, said, let me go back to his typescripts and his handwritten copies just to see if there's anything significant, you know, any differences. Right. And I've found just hundreds of differences. And a lot of them are minor things, you know, just change the word but to though or something like that, you know. And isn't worth mentioning, but there's a few sections where there's lines that were rewritten or things that were cut out. And I'm trying to work on a way of notating some of the more significant things that existed in the early drafts that didn't make it into print.
Right.
It'll be worth the wait, though. It's an awesome book.
How long have you been working on it?
Well, originally it was supposed to be for the centennial of Sword of Song, which would have been 2003. So I'm a little behind schedule.
Well, as a spokesperson for Thelema, did you expect to be interviewed on PBS specials one day or podcasts and all of this? Or is this kind of a surprise that you've kind of developed into this authority and spokesperson? Or do you think you're not a spokesperson and I'm incorrect?
Well, I mean, some of the stuff, like some interviews I kind of expected would happen as a result of having written Perdurabo. And so I've done some radio shows, and it's always a pleasant surprise. And I'm really thrilled when people want to talk to me and ask about Crowley. But at the same time, you know, I've also been out there lecturing very publicly for the past 20 years. So in a way, it's not like the first time I've spoken to the public, but it's being on the radio is again, very different because you reach a much bigger audience. And certainly when I was asked to be on, you know, these TV shows, that was, you know, just an amazing surprise. And the neatest thing was this one that I was in, Secrets of the Occult, was actually filmed at Silver Cup Studios in New York.
Oh, okay.
And it was just it was a trip to me because I got there and I pulled up and I saw Silver Cup and I went, oh my God, that's the scene from Highlander. You know, it was just and the idea that I was, you know, in this studio being, you know, interviewed and filmed was pretty wild.
Yeah, that's great.
But it's a great opportunity, and it's a great privilege, and it's also a great responsibility for me. When I started, you know, lecturing publicly about 20 years ago, I noticed two things. One is that there were a lot of people who had wild misconceptions about Crowley. And that's kind of what prompted me to continue doing this.
Sure.
And the other thing that I noticed was that I knew a lot of people, some were Thelemites, some were Wiccans, and some were of other paths, who couldn't be really open about their spirituality for fear that they would lose their jobs over it.
Right.
And that's why from day one, it was really important for me to go out there and just use my real name.
Sure.
You know, I haven't, you know, fortunately had any repercussions from it, and you know, it's if someone can, you know, look at me and go, "Oh, Richard, he's a Thelemite," but you know, he's a college professor, he's a research scientist, he's taught hundreds of medical students, and he seems sane. You know, you know what he says makes sense, and
right, yes.
And if that experience, you know, makes even one person say, "Well, you know, maybe I should check out this Thelema stuff,"
sure.
Or if it makes one person feel that they can be a little bit more open about their own spirituality, then I'll feel that I've succeeded.
Sure. Is there any other forthcoming writing projects you'd like to talk about?
Well, the big one right now, and which is kind of slowed down sort of song, is that I am working on a revised and expanded edition of Perdurabo, my biography of Aleister Crowley. And the plan there is that I'm going to be adding somewhere around 50 to 100 pages cumulatively, not all in one block, but you know, it's assaulted throughout about 150 to 100 pages of new material based on research that I've done since the book came out. And you know, that's kind of motivated by the fact that there's a lot of new information that's become available just in the few years since the first edition of Perdurabo came along. So it will be, you know, substantially expanded. It will include pictures, so I'm really happy about that.
Right.
And the plan right now is for that book to be out next year in 2010, late summer, early fall. So for everyone who's been like looking for a copy and kind of choking on the prices on eBay or whatever, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay, great. Weren't you also doing some research on occult organizations of the 1800s? Is there a project you're working in that, or is it what was that research about?
Yeah, and that's kind of a longer-term project of mine, just because the amount of research that needs to be done is huge, and it's going to be like years in the making. But
gotcha.
I'm working on a project that I jokingly described as the story of how Theodore Royce grew up to become Darth Vader. The better comparison actually might be to talk about Jocelyn Godwin's book, The Theosophical Enlightenment.
Okay.
Fantastic book that talks about how the various esoteric and cultural streams of the 1700s and 1800s influenced theosophy. And I'm kind of doing the same thing, except rather than following all this stuff into theosophy, I'm following it into modern-day secret societies like OTO, the Golden Dawn, and the Rosicrucians. Part of what I'm especially interested in researching are the various organizations and rites that the established groups considered spurious, irregular, or clandestine. Because those are the people, people like John Yarker, Wynne Westcott, Gerard Nkos, Carl Kellner. These are people who are motivated not, for a desire to be accepted, but they were really on a genuine quest for the mysteries.
Sure.
And their thinking, permeates and influences all these esoteric groups down to the present day. So that's kind of where I want to focus that book.
Gotcha.
It might actually wind up being two books because there's so much stuff.
Any particularly interesting things you could throw out? Or do you want to save it all for the publication?
There's so much. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to begin to pick, one tidbit. One other writing project that I would be remiss not to mention is that I recently finished writing a 50-page article on the Thoth Tarot, and it's going to be showing up in a two-volume academic book that's going to be coming out in late 2010. And the book will be called Tarot and Culture, and it's being edited by Emily Auger, who is an academic who wrote a book called Tarot and Other Meditation Decks. And I'm not entirely sure about this because I'm not really doing anything other than contributing, a chapter to the book. But I think that tarot scholar Michael Dummett might also be contributing to this volume. And it's really cool because what I did in my paper is that I really wanted to talk about the collaborative process between Crowley and Frieda Harris and how that led to the Thoth Tarot and its creation, where it fits into the history of the tarot and how it's different, and also what kinds of influences each of these two people brought to the project.
Sure. And, especially Lady Harris, because so little is really known, or widely known, I guess I should say.
Yeah, and I really feel like she hasn't really been done justice, and while a paper like mine can't completely, be a biography of Frieda Harris, I do feel like I've dug up some stuff that just hasn't been widely known, and that hopefully this begins to correct the record and begin to do her some justice. And
sure.
The paper is really cool. I mean, it's going to contain, examples of rejected drafts of some of the Thoth decks and comparing them to the finished cards and stuff, and really looking at some of Frieda Harris's own influences going back into the Anthroposophical Society and so on.
Sure.
So it's gonna be a good read.
And you also were working on a Noticon Proceedings book for the last Noticon.
Yes, we've got a selection of papers, about 15 in all, that were presented at Noticon in Salem in 2007 that have been edited and put together into book form, and it will be launched at Noticon this year. So that's in August in Seattle.
And are you working on another Noticon Proceedings book for this Noticon?
Yes, the idea here is that the publication of a Proceedings book is part of the strategic plan of the United States Grand Lodge of OTO. And we want to keep this going. The 2007 was a good year to begin because it's the 10-year anniversary, or if you will, the jubilee of the first Noticon.
Right.
And it was a lot of work because essentially a lot of stuff had to be sorted out, stuff like capitalization. You know, some people want to capitalize everything and some people don't. And how do you compromise between that? How do you standardize things like citations and so on?
Sure.
And now that there have been a lot of lessons learned and this first book can work as a kind of a style manual for the future, I'm real looking forward to putting together a team of people that can work on future volumes and do them in a much less laborious way.
Sure.
Now that we got the ball rolling.
Yeah, exactly. Once you start it, you can get the momentum going.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, you're mentioning Noticon. You're obviously very visible on the U.S. Grand Lodge national scene. What are some other responsibilities you have? You had mentioned before when we had spoken the Advanced Initiator Training Program.
Yes. That's a program that it's kind of a follow-up to the standard initiation training that U.S. Grand Lodge provides for its initiators. And Advanced Initiator Training basically deals with important topics that we don't have the time to cover in the standard training that we do. So we get into things like psychology, music, memorization, logistics, paperwork, and just all those other things that we really can't get into otherwise.
Right.
My own personal presentation focuses on what Aleister Crowley himself had to say about the first four OTO degrees, Minerva through third degree, which are the degrees that get covered in these trainings. And my emphasis here is to be talking about the symbolism of the degrees. And what motivates that is that there's a lot of people who have a lot of theories and ideas that are just wonderful about what the symbolism of these initiation rituals means.
Right.
But what I wanted to be able to do is take a step back and establish a baseline of what we know that Crowley intended. And kind of start from there and say, okay, this is what Crowley put there, at least that we know that he put there. Anything beyond that, may well be, valid and enlightening, but let's at least,
start with that.
Start from there. And, some other Grand Lodge things that I'm involved in. There's the Education Committee, and the goal of that committee is to produce teaching materials that OTO bodies can choose to use. I think the thing that's important to clarify with that is that it's not like we're trying to standardize of a curriculum, or if you're going to be teaching a lesser banishing ritual of a pentagram class, you have to use the curriculum that we put out there. The idea is basically that we want to provide support for bodies that want to teach classes but maybe don't have an idea where to begin. And for those bodies, if having an outline or a presentation or handouts or whatever, if that helps them to start doing classes, that's great. If you've got people there who can teach the stuff and you don't need the handouts, that's super as well.
Right. So it's just there to get people started if they need something to begin with. Yeah.
It's there to help. I'm also on the editorial board of the Psychology Guild. The Psychology Guild is one of its big projects recently has been doing pastoral counseling to members of the EGC clergy. And that's something that I haven't personally been involved in. That's been the work of the people on the Psychology Guild who have been much more involved in therapy and psychology, whereas my expertise has been more in research. In my capacity on the editorial board, I do help out with editing the journal of the Psychology Guild, Neshama, and some of the production on its newsletter. And there's probably other things that I'm forgetting, but those are a few of the hats that I wear.
So how do you balance all your time doing all these things?
Time?
Yeah, time.
What time?
Yeah. What is that?
I can't say it's a full-time job because I've got a full-time job, but it keeps me busy. I mean, just between the writing and the OTO activities, I mean, it's what I do, and that's part of why I haven't really had time to do some of the music and other things. But it's very fulfilling. You know, it's not that anyone holds a gun to my head and says, you have to do this. You know, these are all things I do by choice because I care about them.
So if there was a closing thought you wanted to leave with everyone, how do you see the world of Thelema growing in terms of an actual culture?
I think I see our Thelema culture currently kind of following two paths. And the one path is that there seems to be this concerted effort to educate the public about what it is that Crowley was all about, what his message really was, because there's just been so much misinformation that has been put out there and just which persists. And through projects like putting out definitive editions of Crowley's works, through me writing this biography, through you doing this radio show and interviewing the people that you're interviewing, that getting the facts out there and established is one very important thing that we as a culture need to do to move forward. Because part of the goal of OTO is to promulgate, to find people who might be interested in this. And if they can't find the information or they can't find the correct facts, then that's not going to happen. So I think that's part of what has to happen. But the other thing that I see as being a necessary next step is that, we need to also have some new and original scholarship happening in our field. So we're not just going back to, what did Crowley say, but we're building upon that. And I'm real excited to see a lot of that happening as well. We've got some talented teachers in the order who are doing this fantastic work. Lon Duquette is just one example that comes to mind. But, the proceedings book is filled with, 15 papers of people who are doing that same kind of work. And, just recently, Dan Gunther's new book came out, which has, again, kind of propelled the field and the culture forward in a significant way. And it's just that kind of stuff, kind of doing new work, that kind of extends and builds on what the foundation that Crowley gave us is,
right.
The second way that I see our culture moving.
Well, I want to thank you for having this time with us, and I hope when the Sword of Song eventually is finished, you'll come and talk to us about that too, and maybe other times, especially if you get a music project going.
Yeah, it would be great.
Rich, I want to thank you for joining us here today on Thelema Now.
It was a pleasure.
Our guest today was Dr. Richard Kaczynski, author of Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, and The Wiser, Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley. To find out more about Richard and his books, Richard, what's the best way to reach you on LiveJournal?
Yeah, LiveJournal is probably the best way to kind of check in on me, and you can find me there under my name. It's Richard_Kaczynski, except you have to leave off the SKI, because there's not enough room in LiveJournal. But that's my username, and again, Richard_Kachin. And look forward to seeing some of you there.
Thanks to listening to Thelema Now.
You've been listening to Thelema Now, hosted by Frater Puck and produced with the support of the Ordo Templi Orientis USA Grand Lodge. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the OTO USA or any of their officers or directors. Thelema Now's mission is to provide listeners with interesting, informative, and thought-provoking interviews featuring people involved in mysticism, spirituality, and magical theory and practice. Our theme music is provided by Fern Knight, and our producer is Soror Amy. Until next time, 93.